Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. 500,000 Americans have died of the coronavirus pandemic, and debate in Congress continues about the future of the stimulus package. As we tape this, President Biden is addressing the Munich Security Conference. Joining us today is our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and the world are Dr. Gordon Adams, a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center and a professor emeritus at American University, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense lobbying firms, Terry Schultz, who reports for Deutsche Welle and National Public Radio from Brussels, Dr. Dov Zakheim, who among his many hats is a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. We're going to do something a little bit different. Michael is going to start us off. Then Terry Schultz is going to talk about the NATO ministerial. And as we tape this, President Biden is addressing the Munich Security Conference. So Gordon and Dov are going to do the yeoman's duty of assessing the president's remarks on this action-packed program. Michael, start us off. A lot of activity going on the Hill. Congress is in recess, but that doesn't mean that folks aren't busy. We've got new subcommittee chairs. As the Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman Jack Reed has said, the defense cuts are likely. And the worst thing in Washington is when there's a confluence between the parties, because Kel Sapri's conservatives now want defense cuts as well. Walk us through what's going on.
Okay, sure. So in the previous podcast, we talked about the changes on the House side on the National Security Committees, and now the Senate has made their changes as well. So there's some new subcommittee chairs on Jack Reed's Committee on Armed Services. Tammy Duckworth is now the chair of the Air Land Subcommittee. Angus King, who was the ranking on Air Land, is now the chair of the Strategic Forces Subcommittee. We had all thought, you know, the rumor mill was that Mazie Hirono was going to take a subcommittee chairmanship on another committee, but she chose to stay and keep the and take Sea Power. Kevin Kramer from North Dakota is now the new ranking member of Sea Power. And freshman Senator Mark Kelly from Arizona is already a subcommittee chairman on Armed Services, chairing the Emerging Threats and Capabilities Subcommittee. So to get to your comments on Jack Reed, I think we really got to look at very carefully about, you know, how they were reported and what he really said, right? So, you know, Senator Reed is saying that the Pentagon is going to keep pace with adversaries. We've got to take a hard look at weapon systems that are politically popular, but no longer guarantee a military advantage on the battlefield. And he also said that Congress is to blame for a lot of this spending of these critical dollars. But he came up strong against the progressive move for across the board cuts in defense. He says, we got to look at this, you know, program by program. And he also laid out, you know, his top priorities, which are really battling COVID-19 and addressing the lack of diversity in the military, including tackling extremism in the ranks and gender inequality. He also said that another one of his priorities is, you know, transformation of the Pentagon and the military to adapt to threats from China and Russia, which means, again, a scrub of Pentagon spending and a look at the national security strategy. You know, is the strategy now valid? What are the assumptions? You know, what changes do we need to make? And he predicted a major debate over nuclear weapons spending, including plans for a new intercontinental ballistic missile, which, again, is no surprise, as well as the future of troops in Afghanistan. But that being said, I think, you know, we have to define what is a cut, what's not a cut. And I think that the belief in town is that the budget is going to remain flat, but not adjusted for inflation, which still is a cut. And the Republicans are putting down their marker saying, hey, you can't pass any of these bills without our votes, because there are Democrats that will vote against the defense bill no matter what the number is. And they do not want to see a cut in defense spending. So they're willing to accept flat defense spending, not adjusted for inflation. And they're also saying Mike Rogers, who's the new ranking on House Armed Services, is laying his marker down. Not only is it the number, but how is that money spent? So, you know, this debate is far from over, but I really don't see a big divergence between the Republicans and Democrats who I've talked to on Capitol Hill.
The administration wants $1.9 trillion for COVID relief. We've seen news reports this week, and the administration has suggested $2 to $3 trillion more on infrastructure, and that doesn't include climate at this point. Presumably, the first two bits, if not all three of them, would pass by reconciliation. What are you hearing from lawmakers? Where are we? What does this mean? And how does this affect the entire enchilada?
Well, you're right. They're already talking about the second bill, and they haven't even passed the first one yet. So let's talk about the first one.
And we haven't even spent money from the last one, right? So
exactly. You sound like a Republican now, Vago, because that's what the Republicans are saying.
I'm sorry. I'm an independent. I'm an equal opportunity critic, and I've been plaguing administrations for the last 30 years, hopefully in a bipartisan manner. But go on.
Okay. So, you know, the Democrats are planning on holding a floor vote next week on the reconciliation package, which is really their COVID relief package. And remember, all this has got to get done in the House and Senate and sent to the president before March 14th, because that's when the key unemployment provisions from the previous packages expire. So they're under a lot of time pressure. So this package right now, you know, is about $1.9 trillion, as we know. And you know, Republicans are not on board with this. And this will be the first relief package that will be passed along partisan lines. The Republicans feel the price tag's too high, and they object to a lot of things in there, like the minimum wage and also how much money there is for state and local aid. Minimum wage is definitely going to be a challenge in this bill. I think that it'll probably stay in the House version of the bill to keep the progressives happy, because they're going to need every vote they can to get it passed. But really what matters is what passes the Senate. So it will, after the Senate passes their version, will they have to reconcile the two and conference them and send them back to both chambers, or will the House just pass the Senate version? And the House is planning on voting whatever the final version is, whether it's a conference version or the Senate version, the week of March 8th. So this is moving very quickly. But as you correctly pointed out earlier, they're already talking about another package after this, because they do have two reconciliation vehicles they can use this year. And the next package, it was going to be, is already reported to be a massive spending bill, as much as $3 trillion in new spending. And they envision, you know, wide-ranging jobs and infrastructure package, which they say will be the foundation of what Biden's called his Build Back Better program. Now, remember, this would come on top of possibly a $1.9 trillion package passing in the next couple of weeks, and $4 trillion that's already passed under the previous administration. So this package would focus on infrastructure investment, also tackling other things like clean energy, domestic manufacturing, childcare, and it's really just unleashing a whole bunch of other demands among the Democrats, which actually threatens to divide the Democrats, not to mention a brewing fight in that package on tax increases and which taxes to increase and how much.
And then real quick, right, earmarks are coming back. Yay, welcome back. Pelosi's January 6th commission, and then Biden's ambitious immigration reform plan, right? I mean, how could these affect defense as well in their own way?
Well, first, let me say, like, I give Biden a lot of credit for coming out aggressively with a lot of things early on in his administration, which a lot of administrations don't do, even without having a narrow majority. He's trying to lay down as many markers as he can, and I think he deserves a lot of credit for that. At the end, we'll see what really gets done. I mean, this, you know, the immigration overhaul, which was just released yesterday, you know, it takes a lot of guts, because that's been I remember talking about this with members of both parties for the last 20 years, and we've seen no progress. So it'd be really a sweeping immigration bill that would provide an 8-year path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. It would raise the current per country caps for visas and change the word alien to non-citizen. So, you know, we'll see. Pelosi, no surprise, is pushing forth with her January 6th commission. Republicans are worried about it. They're warning that this should not be another attempt to relitigate the impeachment of Donald Trump. But, you know, as we've seen, even among the Capitol Police, I mean, 92% of the Capitol Police officers just had no confidence vote in their acting police chief. And as more and more comes out, I think there's going to be consensus among both sides that we need to figure out what happened to prevent it from happening again, so they can dismantle the fortress that surrounds, you know, the people's house. And you know, as far as earmarks go, I wouldn't get too excited about that just yet. You know, the Democrats want to bring them back. I think they're correct to try and bring them back. But the plan now is to bring them back just for not-for-profits and for state and local government. So it would really not impact the defense industry and private companies like it did in the old days. And it should come as no surprise that Republicans and conservative groups are fighting back against it and opposing earmarks purely for political purposes by accusing them of you know, wasteful spending, which of course it's not, because you know, the budgets are set and you're really robbing Peter to pay Paul with these earmarks and using their congressional authority to decide how money is spent. So this fight has just begun, but I do see the Democrats bringing them back in a limited fashion for not-for-profits and for state and local governments, especially when it comes to infrastructure and transportation.
the two things I would say on earmarks, I like earmarks. Earmarks have driven defense progress. And as the late, great Jack Murtha used to say, right, it's the lubricant. It allows you to get deals done that you would not otherwise be able to get, right? And so the world's greatest democracy does require something to work. On January 6th, right, even though the police officers voted had that vote of no confidence, now, right, as part of the continuing investigation, a number of those police officers are under investigation for, you know, having had links potentially or been involved on behalf of the insurgents or whatever. And so there is good reason why some of the Republican members may not want the scrutiny, right? I mean, it would be very, very awkward if members of Congress were directly implicated as being complicit in what happened on January the 6th. So from their standpoint, you know,
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree.
Any investigation.
There's still the threat of legal jeopardy for the president. So depending on what evidence is produced that was not produced in the impeachment trial could also pose legal jeopardy for the president. And I think just really quick, your comments on earmarks is spot on. Like I remember when I first started lobbying, the Defense Appropriations Bill was passed in September every year. We had 13 appropriations bills in those days, and they were all passed individually. Now we're passing almost one package at the end of December because there isn't that lubricant that you mentioned to help move the process along.
Well, it was also because people actually legislated at the time. I know that you and I are all of us are old enough to remember actually legislation, right? And also an obligation to start the fiscal year on October 1 with actually legislation in place. Michael, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Have a great weekend. And we're going to start off our broader conversation. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And now I want to go to Terry. Byron, I want to start off with you, right? I mean, you've been following this process pretty carefully, wrote a series of very thoughtful notes over the course of the week on spending, on inflation, right? I mean, one of Wall Street's number one concerns, and among some in Washington, is that once inflation starts, it gets a mind of its own. And when you have $28 trillion in debt, that's a little bit harder to get through. Where do you think we are and where we're going in terms of sort of the fiscal picture? And how it's going to affect the industry?
Well, I think that's the big question. I mean, the signal the market is sending about this is the 10-year is now back to 1.3%. You know, that's still below the estimates of CBO or OMB have been using. But I think the fact is, you know, the trend is changing. And I think, you know, the market, from my standpoint, is still not certain about the timing or the ultimate magnitude of what gets done in this second package that the administration wants to get through. I mean, there are all sorts of complications. You know, can this really be done by reconciliation? Will there need to be parts that are broken out and treated separately when you get into things like, you know, promoting electric vehicles and the infrastructure that would support those? So I agree that's kind of next on deck, but I think, you know, defense isn't really wrapped up in this as much as it's the potential collateral damage that could occur if we really start to see inflation and rates increase, and that will have a bearing on the resources available for defense.
Gordon, what's your sense on where we are and where we're going and how we can spend so much money and manage to get away with it, right? I mean, at the end of the day, Larry Summers, as well as some other Democrats that I've spoken to, think that, I mean, it's important to go big, but maybe we may not need to go as big as we're going. What's your sense on where we are and where we are going?
Yeah, everybody's going to have a different opinion on this. And of course, a lot of that opinion is going to be driven by politics. I did listen to an interesting debate, really, between Larry Summers and Paul Krugman this week. And Krugman's rebuttal, if you will, of Summers' concern, and Summers made it clear that this was a concern, not an econometrician's judgment, but a concern, is that the packages that we're talking about putting in at different points in time are different kinds of packages, and ergo spend out at different rates. So if you come in later this spring with a $2 or $3 billion package that's heavy in infrastructure things. The reality is infrastructure payments happen over a much, much longer period of time. They're kind of like long-term defense procurement items, not like near-term, you know, stimulus checks in people's wallets. So part of Paul's argument was the spend-out rates are going to differ here. The economic impact is not likely to be in the inflationary direction that Larry was worried about. So that's one set of issues. There's a whole discussion, as you know, about state and local governments. And I think here people are playing partisan advantage, if you will. The Republicans seem to be arguing, you know, that what the needs for the state and local government should be are lost revenues. And we estimate that at about $120 billion, not $350. And of course, what the Democrats are arguing is $350 is more like the extra expenses that have been incurred for things like higher unemployment insurance and the programs that states have introduced, unemployment, COVID assistance, that they've had to cover without any additional resources to do it. And that's makes the $350 billion look like an appropriate number. So you can have your argument either way, but it's basically a partisan fight that's being had there because the Republicans don't want to give money to localities that are governed by Democrats. So that's part of what's going on there. I'm not too concerned about ruffled feathers on the $1.9 trillion package. It's probably going to be a reconciliation thing. It's going through that process. The Republicans will oppose it. The Democrats will be for it. We'll probably lose the $15 minimum wage. The president's signaled that pretty directly and bluntly at this point. And that will make Senator Manchin happy. And the program will go through the Senate as a consequence. And Senator Sinema, too, I might add. So it's likely to go through. And I think the long-term package is likely to go through, too. But again, you know, if one buys Krugman's argument, the spend-out rates are going to keep it from being trending in the direction that Summers is worried about. Predictions are difficult, especially about the future. So we'll see how those spend-out rates going. But that first package, I think, will go through on reconciliation. And the second one's likely to be a reconciliation piece, too. I can't see the Republicans caving on that one quite this early.
And are you at all concerned about the inflation and national debt arguments on this, or do you consider them overwrought?
I think they're a little bit exaggerated. Larry knows how to get publicity. As I say, prediction's difficult. You know, it's hard to know what that is going to be, and it'll be determined by a lot of economic phenomena that we can't really accurately predict at this point. I'm not anxious about it. I'm not saying, oh my God, we are suddenly pumping too much into an economy that's already overheated. We know parts of the economy are overheated, and we know parts of the economy are way underheated at this point. So we're not getting accurate data yet on projecting the future. And it's worth pointing out that the Fed has been, the numbers you provided, you know, $4 trillion here and $1 trillion there, after a while it adds up to real money. But in addition, the Fed has been pumping trillions of dollars into acquisitions in the economy through Fed resources that aren't measured in those numbers. So in a sense, we've already had a huge explosion of expenditure, which I would say has not had an inflationary impact as yet. It has really supported the economy through COVID, which otherwise would have devastated the economy.
Dove, what's your sense on where we are?
I'm a little bit more worried, I think, than Gordon is. For a start, the spend-out argument, as Gordon well knows, yes, you're not going to spend 100% in the first year, but you're not going to spend 5% in the first year either. So you got to look at where we are right now, which is somewhere close to $28 trillion in debt. Add the 1.9, which I totally agree with Gordon, is going to go through pretty close to that number. So you're at about 30. And then if you said, okay, fine, one third of it will be spent early on, you're now talking over $30 trillion with a gross domestic product, $10 trillion less. We tend to straight line everything. Washington is a place where you straight line. And so everybody's straight lining low inflation the way they used to straight line high inflation. And my concern is much closer to where Summers is, simply because we always surprise ourselves. And what happens if inflation goes up? And this has a direct impact on the defense budget, because now you're talking about much higher debt service costs. And oh, by the way, with China holding a lot of our paper and money being fungible, we're probably going to be financing even more of the Chinese defense budget. A whole other conversation, I would add. But it does seem to me that the pressures on the defense budget are going to grow far greater than they are today, if indeed inflation goes up, and not by a lot. If it goes up a percentage point, and maybe even less than that, maybe 200 basis points, you're talking about a significant degree of pressure on the defense budget that we don't have today. So beware of straight lining.
Are you concerned that Republicans, or at least conservatives, are now coming out and sort of expressing support for defense cuts?
In terms of the conservatives, I'm not in the least bit surprised. I mean, who are the people who are pushing this? These are the same people, the Tea Party crowd, that forgot about the tea for the last 4 years. Hypocrisy knows no bounds.
As we saw recently from the senator from Texas.
He's Mr. Sunshine.
Byron, let me bring you in this, because we're going to bring Terry on in a minute to give us sort of an update on the NATO ministerial, as well as the administration's engagement with the EU on Iran. But I want to get your sense on the study that the chief of staff of the United States Air Force, C.Q. Brown, mentioned, a tactical aviation review along with CAPE, and looking for a new F-16, right? I mean, he talked about the importance of stealth, but a tactical fighter that can get us there faster, but is still network enabled. And that would seem a little problematic, wouldn't it? At the same time, the United States is trying to acquire and field the F-35. I mean, do you look at this as a potential bullet in the program, or the paving away of a ramp down, when everybody's expectation has been a robust ramp up for this program?
I mean, it's been very curious. I mean, I think Aviation Week first kind of broke this story back January 21st. And then it was confirmed in a defense writers group event on February 17th. It'll be interesting because next week the Air Force Association holds their annual, I think now it's changed to the Aerospace Warfare Conference. That'll be done virtually. So it's probably going to be talked about there too. Clearly, you know, it suggests that whatever the Air Force thought about the program of record for the F-35A, It's unaffordable. It may be a combination of both unit prices and the operating cost of this. I think what's more interesting, though, is why are you talking about what effectively is you know, an F-16 replacement that's still going to need a fixed infrastructure. You know, there wasn't discussion about whether or not this is autonomous, and I just wonder if this is kind of opening a jar of a whole range of discussions that should really take place around what the Air Force TAC air modernization plan is going to be. You know, where does some of these loyal wingman concepts fit into this thing? You know, should you really be building a bigger fleet of aircraft that's going to need 8,000 foot, 10,000 foot runways to operate from? You know, is that appropriate in the context of a potential conflict in the Western Pacific, where those facilities, I think, are going to be stressed, to put it mildly. So I just wonder, you know, I think it's just one of those inflection points where people are finally coming around to admitting that, hey, if you have a strategy and that strategy needed 3-5% real growth, and you're not going to get 3-5% real growth, you have to start looking at alternatives. And it's not just the Air Force that's going to be facing this. It's going to be the other military services too.
I mean, the administration has launched a whole series of reviews. Force structure is one of them, and Army leadership has discussed that as well. Let me ask you very briefly, and Gordon, I know you've got a point before we go to Terry, who's on a very short leash. What's the impact on Lockheed Martin on this? Because the company has had this program, has defended it, has made quite a lot of money on it. What are the implications if this program ends up being capped at, say, 1,200 planes or 900 planes, as opposed to 3,300 or 4,000?
Well, there's nothing to say that they can't also participate in this. I mean, Lockheed probably has classified programs. Lockheed, you know, could come up with a lower cost version of the F-16. I mean, there's nothing to say that they could acquire one of the companies that may ultimately build these products, but
Kratos or somebody else who,
Kratos would come up, you know, it's fascinating to see, the Ministry of Defense for the Royal Air Force, for their Loyal Wingman program, announced that they were going with a team that included Spirit Aerosystems in a facility they have in Belfast, Northern Ireland. So it's kind of like the Navy and shipbuilding where, you know, when you start looking at these lower cost solutions, you really open up the aperture to the industrial base you could tap. And there's some actual goodness in that. So I'm not sure, you know, I would never count Lockheed Martin out in this, but I think it from an investor standpoint, you know, if people are looking at the program of record, I think there was always a question mark about it. But this just adds another question mark to how many F-35s are ultimately going to be built. Because if the Air Force starts to back off its plan, you know, that also is going to weigh on the thinking of other international potential customers and current customers. You know, what should they be looking at too?
I should point out that we're going to be talking about this on the Sunday Business Roundtable with Ron Epstein, Sash Tusa, as well as Richard Amlafia. Gordon, you had one point you wanted to make before we go to Europe, NATO, Iran, et cetera.
Yeah, it sort of takes off right from where Byron left off. Between Jack Reed and the kinds of pressures that we've been talking about fiscally, it seems increasingly likely that the defense budget is going to come in flat, and it may even be flat at $741 billion, not even growth with inflation. And by the way, what I'm hearing reported in recent days is that the defense budget, along with the federal budget, will be delivered target date 3 May, with target date to get data to OMB of 12 April. That's going to mean choice making, basically. And I think Byron was right there. There's a lot of talk in what Reed was saying. The one thing that Reed said that is not a big signal anybody else hasn't sent is legacy program, legacy program, legacy program. So in a lot of the reviews going on in DOD and in the examination that will be given it on the Hill, I think they're going to be looking at things like the production run of the F-35. I've been predicting that would be shorter for years. But also Army helicopter attack and lift, USA A-10 program, again, on the table. There's going to be bill payers that the Pentagon may have in mind, and then we'll watch the politics play out, at the level of the Congress once that budget comes down sometime in early May.
Dove, do you want to have any last word on this before we shift to Europe?
Yeah, very quickly. First, the last Trump budget, the phony budget, already cut back on F-35. So that's a signal right there. But more important, I think what Gordon said, and I agree with him, they're going to make choices. And it's going to be very interesting to see, because if those choices reflect real change, then you have a lot less to worry about when you're thinking about civilian control.
And now I want to go to Terry. Thanks very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure having you back on. Secretary Austin attended the virtual NATO defense ministerial, and obviously the Munich Security Conference is getting underway as we record this. The message, obviously, from the American administration is, you know, that America is back, and European allies who felt both unloved and bullied by Trump are pushing back a little bit and saying, hey, as much as we want your love, we also don't want to get pushed around because we have different approaches on Russia and China, for example, two areas where the administration is taking as tough of a line, if not a tougher line, than his predecessors. What are some of the key takeaways from the ministerial, right? A lot of issues that were packed there from whether it was future policy on Afghanistan, given the administration is considering sticking to the Trump plan to withdraw. And then I also want to ask you a little bit about Iran and what's next there.
Everything that I've heard about the meeting, the two-day meeting, was pretty much a love fest with the U.S. I mean, Secretary General Stoltenberg has brought up some ideas, proposals for reform that are a bit controversial, but the divide is not between the U.S. and everybody else for a change. So that's certainly welcome all around. I mean, this was Austin's first meeting, first official meeting. I will say that he did have, he had called everybody into a meeting on Afghanistan about 2 weeks ago. So it wasn't the first time that he'd seen everybody, but that was, you know, not an official ministerial. So, I mean, everybody came out of that meeting very reassured about the fact that nothing will happen by surprise. There will not be, you know, pullouts by tweet anymore. And you know, it sounds funny, but it wasn't funny because that is actually how things happened. They would find out in the morning, you know, that what the drawdown numbers would be, you know, when they checked Twitter. So, I mean, that's something that really unnerved allies for the last 4 years. And Secretary General Stoltenberg had called for this meeting to be the deciding moment when they would, you know, assess whether the Taliban had lived up to their side of the peace deal, and therefore all foreign troops would be leaving by May 1st. And he had maintained that line right up until the week of the ministerial, even though we knew that the U.S. was not ready to make that call. So they kind of dialed that back at the meeting and said, you know, we're waiting on the U.S. to make its assessment, pressing for more for more progress on the peace plan. Something very interesting that I think probably Washington watchers will have noticed is that the Pentagon is not willing to say at this moment that the Taliban is not living up to the deal. As I understand it, there was a pretty forward-looking statement by John Kirby at the end of January saying that they didn't see that conditions are being met. And that has since been walked back. And efforts to get them to repeat that have been unsuccessful. Meanwhile, here in Brussels, people are much more open about saying that the violence is up, not down. And that was one of the main conditions. So Afghanistan really dominated here, kind of obscuring for a moment that the Iraq training mission is going up from about 500 people to 4,000 people. So that's massive. You know, that's something that is along the lines of NATO's effort to do more on counterterrorism. This is, you know, one of their big programs. So that was the headlines out of the ministerial. The other stuff is that there's some proposals on changing the way operations are funded so that costs would not any longer be paid by countries that are sending all the resources. But those things got a bit obscured in the Afghanistan issue.
Let me ask you a follow-up question, because your time with us is very limited. You also covered the EU soon after French President Emmanuel Macron said that France should help vaccinate poor and middle-income nations. President Biden pledged $4 billion to the effort. And the EU has also invited the United States to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal. And the White House has said that it's open to talking to Iran. This comes, unfortunately, right after an attack in Iraq, which is expected to have been launched by Tehran, a deadly rocket attack. What's next on this? Because the American administration said that they want to get into the Iran deal. Dove and Gordon, I want to get your sense on this a little bit later. But talk to us a little bit about the negotiations, what this means, how the United States is re-engaging, and what's sort of the chi on the EU side of things, and an EU side of things where the UK, which would have been sort of the standard American interlocutor with the EU, is just not there in that capacity.
Well, you threw a lot in that setup there, Vago. COVID.
Take it in any direction you
COVID
want.
COVID aside, I'll deal with Iran and U.S. engagement with the EU on Iran. And this is something that is extraordinarily welcome, of course, because the E3 remain committed to the Iran deal, the UK, Germany, and France. And they are just so relieved to get the signals from the U.S. administration that they are open to at least discussing with Iran. I have just been in a backgrounder with EU officials talking about this, among other things. And they say, of course, that everything depends on Iran. You know, the U.S. is not saying what it will do yet. It really depends on Iran's behavior. But I can say that on Monday, Secretary Blinken will join virtually a meeting of EU foreign ministers where Iran is going to be one of the key issues discussed. And he will definitely be hearing more about the European Union's hopes that the JCPOA can be revived. But no one is committing to that without knowing what Tehran is going to do. And I understand there's an IAEA visit early next week, maybe even Monday as well, you know, that again will feed in more information. But I can just say that the European Union is just very relieved that, again, that consultations are on the table. So a funny note is that all 27 foreign ministers are going to have their own chance to address Secretary Blinken. So I hope that when he hears this, that he doesn't have another appointment come up. having that ahead of you is, it's going to be a long afternoon.
Well, I think there are some people who are looking at that as right. That's time well spent to try to help reset some of these relations. Let me ask you one last thing briefly, right? I mean, but there are some tensions after the last 4 years. Armin Laschet, who is likely to succeed Angela Merkel, has made it clear that Europe has its own interests, right? So even though the Biden team said, hey, stick with us, hold off on doing a China deal until we get into office, Europe went ahead and did the China deal and Nord Stream and all of that. Is this going to be, for all the love fest elements of it, a little bit rockier of a relationship as Europe tries to assert its own sovereignty and independence from the United States?
Well, those things won't go away. Although I did just see a report. I didn't look into it, so I'm not confirming it for sure. But I saw that there will be new entities put on a sanctions list, but that German companies won't be on them when it comes to Nord Stream 2. There may be ways to negotiate this. Nord Stream 2, of course, is a constant irritant, and that won't go away. I think that whatever differences remain, and you know, it's healthy for those are healthy differences. But it's the fact that the Europeans feel like they can pick up the phone and call somebody who will be civil on the other end is just a huge difference. And so much of the stress is gone. Just the stress of not knowing who your interlocutor is and not knowing if that policy is solid or not is just already different. Even before the administration, finishes its policy reviews and sets out new directions, it's clear that consultations are underway. There's just, no a way around how much better people feel. And so I think, there will be strains. If you're talking about China, that's going to be one of the key areas where the U.S. and where the Biden administration is not expected to change its views much from the Trump administration. And the Europeans are going to have to deal with that. But, they've been coming around on things like this anyway to the U.S. view. More and more countries are, not using Chinese technology or putting in place, safeguards against potential Chinese abuse. The EU itself has called for much more attention on foreign purchases of key assets, particularly by Russia and China, which has been a huge concern both for NATO and the European Union. So those kind of things, I think, will smooth out, even if there are differences in views. A lot will depend on, on China and Russia themselves. And those are things that are being watched very carefully. But everybody is, just waiting for the time when, President Biden comes over, most likely by the G7, if not before that, in June. It's just a really refreshed relationship. I think that nobody's going to pretend that everything is going to be completely unanimous transatlantically, but there'll be a conversation, a civil conversation.
Terry, thanks so very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Gordon, why don't you start us off on what, not just what Terry said, but also President Biden's address to the Verkunda conference. Obviously somebody, he's been going to that event for decades, although this time was his first virtual appearance at it, along with the French President Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, obviously the host of the event, and also joined by Boris Johnson. At the end, what did you hear?
President's speech was on point, consistent with themes that he's laid down before, not terribly surprising. He made democracy and the democratic countries his sort of central theme. He talked about earning back our position of trusted leadership. That, I think, downstream raises some other issues about whether the U.S. is yet trusted or can yet be a leader under current circumstances. He gave a strong declaration of support to Article 5, obviously a reference to the weakness on Article 5 from his predecessor. I think what was most interesting about the speech was not the stuff that was new, but it was the stuff he didn't say. He really avoided controversy. All right. The Iranian comments in the president's speech were very general, very consistent with bringing the allies in, working with the allies and doing that. He didn't talk about the difficulties that both the United States and Iran have about hardliner and softliners in both political systems. He didn't mention the pipeline from the Russians. He didn't say a word about terrorism and cooperation on terrorism, except in the Afghanistan context. He didn't mention things that would cause feathers to ruffle, like the European Union's trade agreement with China, which has been ruffled in other contexts, but he did not bring it up here. He made no announcement on Afghanistan. And of course, that was very nicely kicked forward in the NATO ministerial meeting so that the Europeans would back off and wait for the Americans to make a decision about the early May deadline for withdrawal of American forces, which I suspect is not going to happen. So in a sense, it was a stroking speech. It was a speech that patted everybody on the back, said, we're back. We're working with you on Afghanistan. We're working with you on this Iraq counter-ISIS mission, which is going to be ramped up to about 4,000 people, probably primarily Europeans, I would think. Right. He was clearly sent a signal to the Germans, you know, we're not going to draw down. We're raising the cap on U.S. basing in Germany. It was what you would expect and consistent with what the president has said before. And this comes back to, in a part, to what Terry said. You know, I've worked on European security issues for 20 or 30 years before roughly about 2001. And the reason that I kind of stopped working on them was because the Europeans will always, I think, fall short of the commitments that they are going to make in terms of technology and the allies or the purchase of American equipment, or particularly the shoring up of European defense capabilities. So the one thing I think that's going to be very hard for the Europeans going forward is to actually create a quasi-autonomous, deployable, usable military capability. The barriers are just too darn high, and they are sometimes diplomatic. We don't want to insult the Americans by looking independent. They are quite clearly national. The Europeans are divided in military capabilities between German capabilities and French capabilities, and at the time, the British capabilities. That's now off the table. Over decades, the Europeans, since the Saint-Malo Agreement, if nothing else, in the 90s, have said, we're going to create, in the context of the EU, some kind of military capability that will not counter NATO, but it will be a capability the Europeans can use to develop their own security. While they preach it, and when Macron preaches it, I just don't see it happening with any speed whatsoever. Too much money involved, too much national differences involved. It's just not going to happen. So right. If one piece of this is the Europeans are going to step forward with their own capability and beef it up, don't hold your breath.
Dov, what's your sense, not just on the tone the administration struck, as Terry said, you know, at the EU and at NATO, but also the president's speech, right? I mean, as Gordon said, nothing surprising, but you know, I just wanted to get your sense as to whether or not it was important for the president to say it in the way he said it.
Well, absolutely. The fact that it was nothing surprising because we knew what his attitudes were, I think the Europeans had to hear it. They wanted to hear it. They wanted to hear him talk about climate change and about Iran and about alliances and about Article 5 and about having their backs. And the number of times he said America is back, normally you would have thought he overdid it, but not for European ears. And by the way, speaking very, very harshly about China and about Russia. In the case of Russia, of course, again, this is something the Europeans are conflicted about, but worried about. In the case of China as well, he made it very, very clear that however much the strategy may change in other respects, he's not backing away from where Trump was, except he's going to do it a lot more smart, cleverly and subtly, which, again, is what the Europeans wanted to hear.
And very briefly, we have talked a couple of times on this program. It was McKenzie who pointedly pointed out that Netanyahu and Biden hadn't yet spoken. You and I were on the same page that Netanyahu may have to wait for that phone call. The phone call has happened. What do you think?
Well, Netanyahu made a whole play of it. Biden pretty much said, I care about Israel. I'm not so sure I care about you. Netanyahu had insulted Obama in the Oval Office. He had made that speech to a joint just session of Congress without coordinating with the White House. He insulted Biden twice, once in 2010 when Biden came to Israel and Netanyahu authorized new construction in East Jerusalem. He denied it, but he's in charge of everything. And then he did it again when actually twice more. He congratulates Biden 5 days after the election and does that on a tweet which has a picture of him with Trump. And then 8 days before the inauguration, he authorizes 800 new units in the West Bank. So the fact that Biden bothered to talk to him at all, I think, shows that Biden's a real mensch. As for Bibi, that's a whole other issue.
Gentlemen, thanks very much. Thanks very much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Hope you guys have a great weekend and look forward to having you back on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Fargo.
Thanks, Fargo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.